Thank you very much. This is okay. Everyone's hearing me all right? Okay, so I'm going to focus just a little bit on talking about cancer stem cells and solid tumors. The issue here of solid versus liquid, if you like, is really a separation between between leukemias, lymphomas, and most of the other cancers. So there's a lot of work being done in stem cells in the leukemic area and leukemias, and I'm really not going to talk at all about that because most of my background has been in studies of solid tumors, and what I really want to do is talk about the work that's being done to try and extend what's been discovered really in leukemias into the solid tumor area. So we'll start with the definition of a cancer stem cell. This is taken from a paper that was published a couple of years ago. The current concept is that there are a small subpopulation of cells which constitute a reservoir of cells which have the exclusive ability to self-renew and maintain the tumor. So the primary argument here then is that there are cells within the tumor which can generate all the heterogeneous lineages within the cancer, but this number may be relatively small. And this is a relatively simple concept, and it's certainly not new. It's been around for more than 100 years, this idea. And some of the issues that we're going to think about a little bit about is how realistic is it to think of this population as a uniform population within the tumor, and then can we actually identify such cells? And we're going to really focus primarily on this issue. And from the point of view of therapy and outcome, and maybe for modeling, one of the important implications of this model, this concept, is that in order to cure a tumor, you actually only need to kill the stem cells. You're not actually terribly interested in the sensitivity of the downstream populations, the heterogeneous lineages which come from the stem cells, because if you take the view that those cells are essentially committed to becoming end cells, then they're not going to be able to regrow the tumor. That's the essence of our definition. So much of this idea of stem cells and tumors comes more recently from work in normal tissues. And in fact, there's a lot of evidence now that many normal tissues, in fact, contain small populations of stem cells. And we've known for years that this is true in renewal tissues like the bone marrow and the gut and the skin. It's now becoming apparent that many other tissues, the brain and the muscles even, are containing a fraction of cells which actually have the ability to regenerate that tissue, and it's a relatively small fraction of cells. And there's a lot of work being done on signaling pathways. I'm not really going to go into this work, really, on which are involved in this process in the maintaining of this phenotype. And there's a lot of, as I said, there's a lot of basic information coming out there, and relating back to what we heard this morning about the local tissue microenvironment, there is increasing evidence that in normal tissues there can be an area which is sometimes called a stem cell niche, which is the cell kind of finds an environment that is suitable for its maintenance as a stem cell, and if it actually escapes from that environment, then it can no longer maintain stem cell properties. And there are some authors who have actually implicated escape from the niche as a factor which can actually promote tumorigenesis. So there's two issues to think about here, really, in terms of cancer stem cells. One is the issue of origin, the origin of cancer, and the second one is the one I just introduced you to, was the idea of therapy, what's important. So I just put up this definition of essentially of the concept of origins. I mean, we can think of cancer stem cells and cancers as arising from normal stem cells that have lost growth regulation. That's the concept I was just talking about, of cells maybe escaping from the niche or suffering genetic damage. Or we can potentially think of normal progenitor cells. These would be downstream cells which would normally be regarded as downstream of the stem cell in the differentiation pathway, still, well, maturation, maybe a better word, still a dividing population, but a population which is essentially committed, the possibility that such cells in fact can be transformed by mutation such that they flip back into being into having long-term renewal capacity. And there's data in the literature which really supports both of these concepts in relation to stem cells, cancer stem cells. So here then is kind of a general concept which illustrates these ideas. We can think then of a normal stem cell or a progenitor cell undergoing some kind of mutations, generating a cancer stem cell which will then grow and generate a cancer. Some of the cells in the cancer will retain stem cell properties. Many of them will become progenitor cells downstream of the population, which will in theory not retain the ability to regrow that tumor. And so if we treat then with chemotherapy, for example, if that stem cell is resistant to the chemotherapy that we've used, and one of the concepts about stem cells is that may in fact be the case, this may be because stem cells tend to have very low proliferative capacity. This is certainly true in normal tissues. There's also some evidence that stem cells may have the ability to be more resistant to drugs by virtue of the fact that they express pumps on the surface of the cell, which will actually pump noxious chemicals actually out of the cell. So there's reasons to believe that they may be resistant. You may develop a situation where you can kill everything else. These are proliferating cells, so they'll be killed by chemotherapy, which is toxic to proliferating cells, but the tumor will regrow because you haven't been able to kill the stem cell. And we'll come back to this concept a little bit later. Also, we can think about the concept of metastasis. If you think about the fact that a metastasis is a cancer which is growing in another location, and in most cases that cancer, that metastasis, has properties which certainly histologically in terms of are very similar to those of the primary tumor, then you would argue that in fact it's essential that the cell which is going to form a metastasis actually is a stem cell. So this cell has to retain stem cell properties as it passes through to become a metastasis. And this may be one of the reasons, for example, why the metastatic process is relatively inefficient. It may be that relatively few cells which are actually escaping from tumors are able to retain these properties. And we haven't talked about these numbers. We'll come back to talk about these numbers. The fraction of cells in a tumor that may be stem cells can be quite low, and often thought of as 1% of the cells or less, but that is variable, and we'll see that as we go. So what's been has kind of regenerated this field over the last few years is the development of techniques for actually sorting stem cells. We, as I said earlier, there was a lot of data over the last maybe 30, 40, maybe even 50 years suggesting that stem cells existed in tumors, but we never had any way of kind of detecting which ones they were. What's happened now is that people have been able to identify surface markers. These are essentially cell surface proteins which appear to be, which you can select the cells for, and appears to relate to stem cell features. So for example, in a breast cancer, this CD44 positive CD24 minus ESA, that's epithelial surface antigen positive cell, if you select that cell by a sorting process and you test its ability to form a tumor, you find that the ones that are expressing this phenotype are much more capable of transplanting a tumor back into an animal, in this case an immune deprived animal, than they would be if they expressed a CD44 minus or CD24 plus phenotype. And the same is true here for CD133. CD133 positive cells in brain are much more highly capable of forming tumors when you transplant them back than CD33 negative cells. And the same is true about colon, for example. But there are a number of different markers, as you can see, which have been identified. There's no suggestion at this stage that these particular proteins are important for the stem cell features of the tumor. It's just that there are suitable markers on the surface of the cell, and many of them actually have been derived from normal stem cells, which seem to be expressing the same markers. But they allow us to partially select for the cells which are of interest. Interesting question. I'm not aware of anyone who's done that experiment. It probably is the other way around. I mean, Rama talked a little bit about this earlier. There certainly is evidence that you can take, for example, teratinocarcinoma cells, and if you put them into a normal environment, you can actually grow a normal mouse from them. Whether you can do the opposite, I'm not aware of a single experiment where somebody's actually reported that. I don't know whether you... Do you know, Rama? If you actually put it into a cancer, I'm not aware that anyone's actually done that experiment. It's an interesting experiment. So this comes back to what we were just talking about, the kind of our critical definition of stemness for a stem cell, cancer stem cell, is its ability to actually retransplant the tumor. And most people now regard in vivo assays as gold standards for doing this. So when we're doing this experiment with human tumors, which is, I guess, what most of that slide I showed you earlier, really all of those markers are associated with human cancers, what we're really doing is we're transplanting these cells into a immune-deprived mouse. And that can be done in different places in the animal. Sometimes it's done by transplanting into the same organ. So you take a mammary cancer and you're transplanting the mammary gland of a mouse, same in the brain. Sometimes this is done in other locations. And to some extent, where you transplant actually depends, gives you a different result. So this makes things a little tricky in terms of understanding really where we are with the data set, because it's not entirely clear what it is about the phenotype and about the site of transplantation, which is critical. But there are various things that you can do. Very common thing to do is to take Matrigel. We talked about that in the last talk. Matrigel will actually, if you actually mix cells with Matrigel and inject them, they're actually much more likely to grow in an animal than if you don't do that. And there are various other ways of doing this to get improved transplantation. So ideally, optimization of the transplantation procedure is important to knowing really what you've got out of your experiment. So this data, I just put this up really to illustrate the concept that what one is when one does an experiment like this, the way you would do this then is that you would inject different numbers of tumor cells, and you would look at the percent of tumors that actually take at the sites you've injected. And this is the data set taken from an animal model. This is a highly transplantable model system, and what we're doing here is we're taking an untreated population of cells here. And this is our data set. And if you take what we often will do then is read off here at 50% and ask what fraction, how many cells are required to give 50% tumors. And the reason that this is done is that statistically this is probably the best defined region of the survival curve if you have data over the whole range of the curve. If you actually look at this population, you can see that this is running about four or five cells. This is a highly transplanted population, as I told you. So virtually every cell in this population is actually a stem cell in the sense that it's able to transplant the tumor. If you treat with radiation, which is what was done here, then you push these sideways because you kill the cells with the radiation. And in many situations, if you take a primary tumor and cells from a primary tumor, you'll see curves much further up here, and we'll have a look at that. We'll have a look at that interest in a minute. So just going back then to this is 40 years ago, right? This type of experiment then was done in a large range of rodent tumors. These are all spontaneous rodent tumors. And this is the number we're talking about, the TD50. And these leukemias had actually relatively low numbers, close to one in fact. But as you go down here, you can see that some of these solid tumors, carcinomas here, there's an osteosarcoma down here, these numbers become actually quite large. one in this number 10,000 essentially means that one in 10,000, you interpret that as something like one in 10,000 cells is a stem cell in that tumor. It's not exactly one in 10,000 because you got to, because 50%, you get 50% at 0.7 of a cell. So it's the math there is not, is, but this is approximate range that we're talking about. So there's orders of magnitude difference from one tumor to another in animal models. And these kinds of experiments then really have given rise to the idea that in solid tumors, there may be very few stem cells in the tumor. And if you kind of think about what this says then is in relation to the issue of treatment outcome, what we're really saying is that in this particular case, maybe if the tumor contains a billion cells, 10 to the 9 cells, that's about a cubic centimeter of tissue, that's a pretty small tumor for a human, but in a mouse, that's the kind of size of tumor that we'll actually work with. Only 1 in 10,000 of them is actually a cell that we have to kill. In other words, we've actually only got to kill down to 10 to the minus 6 of the cell population in order to get close to cure in this tumor. And so one of the things that we did a number of years ago was actually ask the question, well, does that actually work out in fact? And this is a data set where we've actually plotted the TD50, this is a log to the base 10 number across here, for a group of mammary tumors in mice, and this is the dose of radiation required to cure the tumor. And these tumors were all the same size at the time of treatment. And what you can see is that in general there's a reasonably good correlation between those two numbers. There's a point here which is off up here, but otherwise we've got a pretty good correlation. So that certainly suggests that these two things actually go together. So then, if that's the case, how do we go forward? What can we really do? Well, what we'd really like to be able to do is look at what's happening in the population as it grows. And so one of the other things that we did in this experiment was we actually plated the cells and looked at plating efficiency. So now we're just growing them in egg agarose, and we're asking the question, how many colonies can form in the agarose? And we would argue that stem cells are able to form colonies, but non-stem cells are not, or at least if they did, they could only grow to give a few divisions. So if you look at large colonies, then you ought to be tracking stem cells primarily. And you can see, in fact, if you plot that number against the TD50, this is the number that you require to transplant the tumor, again, you get a reasonably good correlation, although if you actually look at the numbers here, you'll see there's about a factor of 10 difference. You need more cells to get transplantation in vivo than you do in vitro. Now, that may suggest what I was talking about earlier, which is that, in fact, there's a population in there which can form colonies up to a size that we were counting, but could not have gone on to form a tumor if we'd let them continue to grow. And I'll give you a couple of references right at the end from work that was done in Toronto modeling this kind of concept a number of years ago. So if you put that kind of data together, then that's the mouse data. So what we're plotting here then is essentially the plating efficiency of a group of mouse mammary tumors. These are spontaneous mouse mammary tumors. And we're just plotting these as a cumulative, essentially, percentage. And this is a data set from human cervix cancer. This was generated by West et al. In Manchester. And you can see, in fact, that they're reasonably consistent in terms of shape here. What I want you to take away from this graph, though, is that, again, there's a huge range of values here. There's three orders of magnitude, basically, across here. So, again, this suggests what I was showing you earlier, which is the idea that, in fact, it's a low probability event that a cell will be a stem cell, and that it's very variable from one tumor to another. So if one is going to model these kinds of issues, one has got to be able to take that kind of thing into account. So let's move to the present day then. What's going on now? Well, this is data taken from O'Brien and Dick, which was published a couple of years ago. This is work being done in Toronto. It's for colon cancer cells. What they have been doing is using CD133, as a marker for their stem cells in colon cancer. And what they did basically was they prepared cell suspensions from colon cancers or from first or second generation transplants, so-called xenografts in animals. And then they actually calculated, looked at the number of cells required you had to inject in order to get tumor takes. So essentially what they're doing is very similar to the kind of experiment I showed you for the animal model system. We're generating a TD50 value. So if you actually look at this experiment, what you can see is that the cells which are CD133 positive over here, you need about 200 of those cells, something like that, to get a tumor to take. And what they were doing in this experiment was they were actually injecting the cells mixed with Metrogel into the kidney capsule of immune-deprived animals. This turns out to be a very good site for growth of tumors in general. Here is the population. Here's a population which is unsorted. So you get the same shape curve, which is what you would expect, but it's just shifted over by about three orders of magnitude. Here are the CD33 minus cells, way over here. They essentially are, there are very, very few of them conform tumors at all. So the whole thing is shifted over, and these are the approximate numbers down here. So what this again suggests is that what we've done here is we've enriched the population by a substantial amount for stem cells, but we still have to inject 200 cells. So we actually, the interpretation of this data is probably that all we've done is enriched. We haven't in fact isolated just stem cells. The CD133 positive population is clearly enriched for stem cells, but it's not probably just stem cells. What's very interesting about this data is that this difference here, that's the between 200 and 60,000, three orders of magnitude, is actually a surprisingly large number, because if you look at the actual data, what you find is that in the population, the proportion of CD133 positive cells was actually, on average, about 11%. This data is taken from a number of different colon cancers, which I put all together for this plot. But on average, they had about 10% of the cells in the population were 133 positive. So the question is, why is there three orders of magnitude difference up here? And the truth is, we really do not know the answer to that. We have no real idea what the answer to that is. And this is a table that I put together a couple of years ago, maybe less than that now, for a number of different tumors where they've done this kind of experiment here, for different tumors here. And here we're just plotting the number of cells for tumor take. This is essentially the TD50 value. This is unsorted. This is sorted. We got a major gain here, as you can see, in purity. And here's the number of cells expressing the marker of interest in the unsorted population. So these two numbers ought to be the same. But as you can see in general, they're not. This is a case that there's a case down here where they are actually very similar. So here's a case where you might say, well, this actually is what you'd expect. In the unsorted population, we got this number of stem cells, and when we actually sort them out, they're the ones that will form the tumors. We're sorting on the basis of the marker, which in this case is these two markers here. So we're sorting for CD44 positive, CD24 positive cells. Or in this case for brain, it's CD133 positive cells. Mostly these are CD133. Here the pancreas is CD133, CD24, ESA positive cells. And what these numbers here are the percentage of cells in the primary population which actually express those markers. And so what I've done is I've taken these numbers and I've corrected them by these numbers to generate that number for the purpose of comparing these two columns. And what you always see is that this number is larger than this number in most cases. This one is fairly close. This one is very close. But in every other case, you've got this big difference in the numbers. And that's the same as I was showing you here. That's essentially the difference between here and here. It's much larger than you would predict based on the numbers that we have available. So this number does not depend on that kind of issue at all, really. I mean, because this is just a data set which is based on the numbers which come off the experiment. So it doesn't matter how stem cells regenerate themselves for this kind of calculation. But clearly, I guess what we think we know about stem cells is that they can undergo symmetric division, either to form two new stem cells or two non-stem cells, progenitor cells, or they can undergo asymmetric division to produce one of each. And that process is going to be important for understanding, kind of in the modeling process, for how stem cells generate the tumor population. But these numbers do not depend on that at all. They just come straight off the experiment. All of these data is coming out of an experiment, essentially. They made the measurements. This is what they got. There's this discrepancy, and we don't understand why. This is the pancreas data. That's this data set down here, the one that appears to look fairly good. This is the actual plot of the data. And what you can actually see is that this data does not look anything like the colon data I showed you. It's much shallower, and the data is much more scattered. So it's very probable that the analysis that they to generate the numbers that I showed you in that slide there's a very large degree of error associated with those numbers because of the shallow slope of these lines. And the data is not there to make enough data really is not there to make a really good estimate is what it comes down to. So part of the problem that I was expressing in here is that most of this data is actually very soft. This data, actually the one I showed you, is actually the best data set in the literature from this point of view. There's enough data there to make a significant calculation. There's really not enough data in any of these other data sets to make that kind of calculation with any kind of accuracy. So I want to just come back and talk very briefly about the issue of new therapies. One of the issues that has been very, very much in the literature is, if we can identify stem cells, can we generate therapies which actually target stem cells and therefore give ourselves a better chance of curing the tumor? And so this is a very difficult thing to do. And it's difficult to do because of the fact that there's only a small fraction of such cells in tumors. Because the way most drug trials are run is that you take a patient who has failed most other treatments, and then you've got your new treatment, and you try that treatment on the patient, and you look at whether the tumor regresses or not. And the success of the treatment is judged on whether the tumor shrinks. Well, now an experiment in this kind of issue, this is not adequate because we've got a large fraction of cells which are not stem cells and a small fraction which are. If the large fraction of cells responds to the drug, then the tumor will shrink. If the small fraction, which is stem cells, responds but the large fraction doesn't, it'll be a very long time before that tumor shrinks. It'll all depend on how slowly the population is being lost. So, in fact, this requires a whole new dynamic, essentially, for actually working on the therapy, how you actually generate data. So this is going to require a much different way of doing drug trials. This is going to actually make things very tricky, because it's going to require very long-term studies. And that's kind of illustrated in these slides here, where we're really thinking about, in this case, a combination of radiation and maybe in drugs, where if you give radiation and there are surviving cells after radiation, this is just a dose cure curve. If there are a lot of cells at low doses, then you'll get a lot of recurrence. This is control probability, so mostly recurring. As you go up here and give bigger doses, you'll get this type of a curve. If you give a drug as well, then if that drug has a preferential effect on non-stem cells, you won't actually affect the control curve at all, because it will just kind of sit there, because the only cells of interest are the stem cells from control point of view. Whereas if the effect is also on the stem cells, then you'll get a a differential here. But in both cases, you'll get better regression because the drug is attacking the cells which are not stem cells, the green cells here. So we'll see regression in both cases, but in only one case will we actually see improved control. So in order to determine whether this drug is actually effective in terms of local control, we've got to do an experiment which actually looks at long-term outcome. And that's what's difficult in the clinical environment. So I thought I'd just show you this one modeling exercise where we're in, as I say, thinking about modeling here. What we tried to do, and this is a fairly old data set, we tried to model a number of years ago the concept of how a tumor would grow from a stem cell population which had been depleted by treatment. And we were thinking radiation here, but it could be any kind of treatment. So we're thinking about three populations in this cancer. There's a stem cell population, the cancer stem cells. There's a non-stem cell population which has proliferative potential, and we made the assumption that it could undergo a maximum of 10 divisions, up to 10 divisions, before the cells became M cells. And then we got a batch of cells that maybe are unable to proliferate anymore, but they can actually survive in the tumor for a period of time, and we opted to give them 10 intermitotic times maximum survival before they were lost from the tumor. And then we asked the question, well, what happens if we start with 15 stem cells and let the tumor grow? And the critical assumption we made here comes back to the point that you were making earlier about symmetric versus non-symmetric divisions. Well, the assumption we made was that the probability that stem cells would regenerate themselves was 0.51. Now, I'm sure all of you recognize that 0.5 is the stable situation. If the probability is 0.5 that when a stem cell divides, it produces another stem cell, then we just keep the same number of stem cells constant. And in many ways, you can think of that as the normal tissue situation. It isn't, of course, quite the normal tissue situation, because if you damage the normal tissue, then you get regeneration maybe of the stem cells in order to get you back to normal again. Any number greater than 0.5 implies growth. And the reason we chose 0.51, in fact, related to relative growth rates. But we won't come back to that at the point in time. So what I'm really showing you here then is what happens as a function of time. This is total cell number in the tumor now. We start at 15, and we just look at 100 different tumors here randomly. And there are a number of interesting features of this graph. The first one is that some tumors never successfully regrow. In other words, because of this low probability, there's a chance that cells will actually lose their stem cell properties entirely, and the whole cancer will regress. So this is very interesting, because if there's any truth to this kind of modeling, and it's very much based on this assumption, and I'll come back to that in a minute. It actually says you don't have to kill every stem cell necessary to achieve a cure. So that's a very important concept. The second thing which is quite interesting about this is you see that there's a very rapid growth here initially, followed by a flattening out. And in fact, in the end, everything, of course, grows at the same rate. And this rate, of course, is the rate of increase of the stem cell population. So the underlying growth rate of a tumor is actually reflecting the growth rate of the stem cell population, because those are the only cells in the end that can remain in the tumor long term. But many, very large number of the cells, tumors, are coming back from this small number earlier than you would predict if you just kind of put a line in here at the same slope starting at 15. So these tumors, in a sense, are recurring early and maybe never regressing completely because of this feature. So the concept that a tumor doesn't regress well or doesn't disappear completely after treatment, this kind of concept suggests that it may in fact not be telling you that there's a large number of cells are surviving in the tumor. It may just be the nature of the modeling that you do. Well, now there are significant caveats associated with this kind of model. It's a very, very simplistic model, and this is the issue which is the primary one. The fact that we assume this was a fixed number. There are a lot of reasons now to believe that that was a mistake, that we shouldn't have actually done that. That this, in fact, is likely to vary with the environment that the cell is in, and it could well increase as a result of damage. We know, in fact, in bone marrow and in other normal tissues, that this must happen, because if you deplete the stem cell population, it actually regenerates back to a kind of a steady state again. So that requires that the probability of generating new stem cells is above 0.5. So this is happening certainly in normal tissues. It's probably also happening in tumors during therapy. So this is probably an incorrect assumption. How that works and how variable it is from one tumor to another, and even within one stem cell to another within a tumor, we really know nothing about, but likely involves the microenvironment and the conditions in the tumor at the time. We also made the assumption for this calculation that stem cells were proliferating at the same rate as non-stem cells. And it's also true that that's also incorrect. Most normal stem cells appear to proliferate somewhat more slowly than the precursor cell populations that they generate. So it's very possible that in cancers that's true as well. So all that assumption would do is push the curve further over before it becomes a kind of a constant. This is the one that would change the whole population, and we really don't know at this time what that number should be. So just summarizing then. So what kind of questions and what kind of answers do we have at the present time? Do stem cells exist in tumors? The answer to that question is almost certainly yes. How many cells such exist? It's generally assumed that this is a small minority. And as I showed you in animal models, it can often be very much less than 1%. The data that I showed you from the sorting experiments actually suggested that number could be quite high. There are numbers in the order of 10 or 15% of cells which are expressing these surface markers. Now, what we don't know, of course, is what fraction of those cells are true stem cells, but it could be quite high in some tumors. Most cases, we haven't been able to optimize those techniques, so we really don't know that. Those two things go together, if you like. What do we know about the molecular phenotype that allows a cell to manifest as a cancer stem cell, and particularly, is it consistent during tumor growth? And again, we actually know relatively little about this at the present time. We do know that if you do multiple transplantations, the same marker can work again and again. So if you take a tumor which is CD133 positive, you inject it into a mouse, you allow it to grow a tumor, you take that tumor out, you sort the cells for CD133 positivity again, inject those cells back, they are the ones that can form the tumor. There's a proportion of cells in that first transplant which are CD133 negative, and they generally cannot form tumors. So these markers do seem to breed true, certainly over a few generations, but we really don't know to what extent that's true yet in primary human tumors. So another important issue is to what's the extent that all the cancer stem cells are the same. We've already heard some brief discussion about heterogeneity, and the general watchword for tumors is that they're very, very heterogeneous. So every tumor is different in a wide range of features. And so there's every reason, in fact, to expect that there will be variability in the stem cells from a given tumor. And this can arise from various, it could arise as a result of general just growth progression. It could relate to genetic instability. It could also relate to the tumor microenvironment, and we already talked a little bit about hypoxia. There's evidence, in fact, that hypoxia impacts both on the expression of surface markers and also on the ability of a normal cell to remain as a stem cell. So the environment of the tumor may be very important in that regard. Can we grow these cells in culture? Yes, is the answer to that question. We can grow them in culture, at least for short time periods. The most successful way to do that appears to be by growing them as spheroids. Now, here we're growing them on the surface of a collagen layer. We're not growing them in the collagen layer, what we were talking about earlier. But in those kinds of experiments, you can get spheroids, and those spheroids appear to contain stem cells, but they also contain precursor cells. And this is a quote I took from a paper which has just been published in the Journal of Clinical Oncology about neurospheres, which is actually probably one of the earliest areas where the growth of spheroids was thought of as a way to actually maintain the stem cell features of tumors. And this is what it basically is. They're a mixture of neural precursor cells, some of which are stem cells and some of which are progenitor cells. So I promised you a couple of references. Some people may think that we know that there's been a lot of work in Toronto on leukemias. Some people may think that that was all the work that was going on a few years ago, but Ron Buick, who worked originally with Sid Salmon, who was one of the very early pioneers in the stem cell area in solid tumors, worked in Toronto for many years, and here are a couple of modeling papers that came out of some of the data that he generated, primarily with ovarian cancers. And what this data set is about is really the exact features of the hierarchy of cells that you get. You've got stem cells at the top of the hierarchy, and then you've got progenitor cells, and as they move down through the hierarchy, they become less and less capable of metastasizing. So, of proliferating. So what you would argue would be that a precursor cell at the top of the hierarchy would be able to form a larger colony when you grow them in culture than a precursor cell near the bottom of the hierarchy. And this is what this is about. This modeling actually shows, the data that he generated actually shows that that's exactly what you see. And you can model these effects. So if one wants to think about that concept in the terms of the modeling, then it may be of interest to look back at these papers. Thank you very much.